Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and for those of you that have been listening and sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. Please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options and making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. And you can all do me a huge favor. Please forward one of our shows to your social media groups or to someone you know that can benefit from a particular show. And I can tell you right now, after you hear this show, everybody's going to know somebody that can benefit from it. Now, Answers for the Family will continue to address a variety of issues, such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. And we will introduce you to talented authors and new innovations in the areas of health, security, and sometimes fun for you and your family.
The high bar.
There you go. Now, our topic today is breaking the cycle of codependence between parents and young adults. Since 1993, our guest, Douglas Bowden, has worked with more than 2,000 children, adolescents, and young adults in a variety of educational and treatment settings. Currently, he is the CEO of the Bowden Group and has developed considerable experience coaching families. In addition, his expertise includes working with the legal system towards alternatives to sentencing for juvenile and young adult offenders. He is also an expert in the integration of therapeutic outdoor experiential programs in the intervention process. Douglas is the architect of a unique team approach that the Bowden Group brings to its cases and developed an integrative approach to serving clients that he has shared with the industry. He also lectures at hospitals, high schools, and to a wide range of professional groups and colleagues. Douglas has been featured in local, regional, and national newspapers, magazines, and journals, and has appeared on radio and television shows regarding various topics relating to working with children and families. He is the recipient of the National Association of Therapeutic Schools and Programs 2009 Essential Peace Award for outstanding service educating members of Congress and Senate about the therapeutic treatment and education industry. He was also the co-recipient, along with Miriam Bowden, of the 2011 Reaching for the Stars Award from the Sky's the Limit Foundation for their career in outstanding service to young people and their families. Douglas, welcome back to Answers for the Family.
It's good to be here, Alan. Thank you. That's a lot to live up to. I can't believe I wrote that so many years ago about myself.
Well, having known you that long, I know that it's true, and that's actually one of the things is that although we get information from, you know, from different sources as we're putting this together, the fact that I also know you allows me to know that it's true.
Some credibility.
Okay. Yes, exactly. So, as I said in the introduction, we're going to talk about codependency. One of the great things about this show is, and we get a lot of feedback about this, is we send out a press release. And we say, this is who's going to be on the show, and this is what the topic is. So the beauty is that most of the people that choose to listen to this show are interested in that topic, which allows us to go a little deeper than the average show that wants a quick kind of a bullet point answer type of thing. And at least that's the feedback we've gotten.
Fantastic.
So, you know, I know and I've heard you speak on it and such. You know, one of the things that you say about codependency, you know, I've heard you say that it is necessary. Can you explain that?
Well, sure. You know, parenting requires that one be codependent, whether it's a God-given phenomenon or evolutionary, take your pick. We're required to meet the needs of our children when they're young, to save them, to protect them, to help them, to nurture them, mm-hmm. essentially. And it's still fine in young adulthood. The problem is when you start talking about addiction and problematic behavior, failure to launch is a popular term, that the codependent instinct becomes counterproductive and in fact tends to endorse, underwrite, support a negative or self-destructive lifestyle on the part of the young adult.
Mm-hmm. Now, again, many people, as soon as you hear the word codependency, we instantly think of that negative side of it.
Right.
So, which is why I wanted to start with the fact of, you know, there is a positive side to it.
I want to normalize it.
Exactly.
I want to say it's a normal part of parenting, so there's less stigma to acknowledge I'm a codependent, you know, I meet needs of my own by meeting the needs of my children. And I get a lot out of it. There's a lot in it for me to meet the needs of my children. It's just that when it becomes counterproductive is when we need to call it out and it starts to have that more negative connotation.
So for all of the parents out there, and I mean, and I'm included as well, you know, how do we know when we've crossed that line?
Well, here's my quick little reminder. You know, I call the twin pillars that undergird codependency hope and fear.
Okay.
All right. And you can pretty much be sure if you've got a young adult child and you're operating, whatever action or inaction it is as a result of your hope or your fear, you can be sure it's an act of codependency. So when a young adult comes to their parent says, okay, I want to try another stint at community college and I'm going to get a job at the Union 76 station and whatever. And the parent indulges it for the sixth time. You're laughing, but this is true
yeah,
stuff.
I know.
I'm looking at the 76 station out the window. But I don't think kids work in gas stations anymore. That shows how old we are.
Yeah.
So, but you can be sure that it's an act of codependence if you're operating out of hope. The hope at this time is the sixth time is the charm. Or the fear that if I don't continue to indulge these schemes or these requests, things will get worse. Well, if I don't do this, he'll become a drug dealer or she'll become a prostitute and end up dead. So the hope and the fear are the twin pillars of codependency.
You know, we have a question that was emailed in, and I want to thank everybody that takes the time. I know a lot of people work in the middle of the day and they listen to the show later on in the evening, or they get it through iTunes or Stitcher or one of those outlets. But I think we have a question that came in already that touches on that subject that you just mentioned. And this one reads, my sister, who is also my closest friend, is hurting badly over her 27-year-old son who has no ambition, no plans for the future, and who sits in his room playing video games when he is not working at Wendy's. My sister is a widow and alone, and he is freeloading off her constantly and contributing nothing but a token, and this is in quotes, I'll mow the lawn once a month. This person then says, I am out of ideas as to how to help her, as whatever I suggest, she says she is afraid if she forces him out, he will hate her and or will be on the street. And that's from Carolyn in Washington, D.C.
Well, she just named it.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
It's perfect. It's the fear, right? The fear that things will get worse or that he will hate her. You know, she's basically underwriting that which she doesn't want. And in economic terms, mm-hmm. you always get more of what you subsidize, right?
That's a great point.
Well, she's subsidizing it. She's underwriting it. She is supporting his unproductive or counterproductive lifestyle. And she's doing it out of fear of what might happen should she not do it.
Mm-hmm.
This woman is out of ideas. You know, what I say to, if I were coaching that mom, I would coach her towards accepting the possibility that her son becomes homeless, right? That's mm-hmm. a possibility. And maybe we create an extrication plan or we give him notice. But that mom ultimately, again, if she were my client, needs to become clear, consistent, credible, and cohesive in her messaging that she's going to decline to continue to underwrite that lifestyle and accept the possibility of utter and total tragic failure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it reminds me of a case where a mom, similar situation, said, well, you know, I don't think I can go through with this, which was getting her young adult child drug and alcohol treatment, and just said, I don't think that I can go through with this. I can't force them out so that they go through that treatment, and because I know that if I do so, I'll lose my best friend. And I said, I said, your 18-year-old son does not need a 45-year-old best friend.
But she does.
Yeah.
Right?
But in essence, in telling her, you need to look at yourself. You know, he doesn't need a 45-year-old best friend. What's your motivation in this?
Well, he's getting her needs met.
Yeah.
It's her, that's the co and codependent.
Right.
And it's also about control that she believes, and this is true for the woman who's got the sister. Her belief is that she somehow has control over another adult, right? That what he does or doesn't do is under her control. But that's a fallacy. We've never had the kind of control over our children that we'd like to think we do. But the codependent act implies that we have some control over what the outcome is, which is why I tell people, let's let go of the outcome, accept the possibility of failure.
Now, and we've talked a lot about the fear side of it. Go into a little bit more about the hope side, because I think all of us as parents, you know, I mean, we hope that our child is going to be healthy, and then we hope that our child is going to be successful, and we hope that they're going to do a lot of things. Let's talk about the reality of some of that.
Well, I think normal parenting involves hope and prayers for our children's success and enjoyment in life and finding a life partner, whatever sort. And that's all, again, this is where I want to normalize it, Alan. It's all very normal stuff. I indulge the heck out of my kids. And they're not always as grateful as I'd like to see. But it's really in the context of the flameouts that I want to call it out. The hope oftentimes is that if I send my child to rehab, this time it will work. It's the seventh time we've indulged the revolving door of rehab, and the hope is that this time it will work. Well, it always works the last time.
Right. Exactly.
And every addict that I've ever spoken to that's gotten clean in some rehab facility has understood that this is the last time. No longer will my parents indulge this notion out of a hope that this will be the... So we name it. This is the first and the last time
mm-hmm.
that we're going to treatment. And it's, as you said in your introduction, it's more often than not outdoor therapeutic programs. But it's out of hope. And I think sometimes parents' hopefulness gets preyed upon in the treatment industry.
Well, speak about that.
How long we have?
Yeah.
Well, this whole thing leads into the notion that oftentimes families will send their children to treatment out of hope or fear. So it becomes a desperate act of codependence in and of itself. So my fear is that if I don't send you somewhere, things will get worse. My hope is that if I do, you'll get better. But they still, in my view, have to let go of the outcome. Except that it, you know, you're going to spend what you're going to spend. We're going to do this once. And we're not going to bring you back and put you back into the basement on the video games. You're going to have to launch. This is a launching pad.
Mm-hmm.
This is not an event, an episode of treatment to then return back to everything as it was and expect things to be appreciably different going forward. It's not realistic.
Well, I think that brings up a great point, which is aftercare. You know, the aftercare, so the child goes off to the program, they learn a structure. What do you suggest is done, or when you're working with a family, what do you recommend is done with that family to make sure that when that child comes back, they don't go back into the same pattern?
Well, they don't come back. That's really it. You're talking about a young adult. It's time to launch.
If it's a young adult,
so we're talking young adult.
Yeah.
And which is, I think, the context of this particular conversation. It's to say that this is a launching. This is not a single moment of treatment that you're going to return from successfully. We're going to invite you to take ownership of your life and accept the possibility that even with treatment you might not. So, in advance of sending a young adult into treatment, I have these conversations with parents so that they're prepared that this is not an episode. I use these words deliberately, clear, consistent, credible, and cohesive in the message that this is an opportunity to launch, but not an episode of treatment. You're not going to come back here. Mm-hmm. You're going to figure out where you can be on your own to internalize those skills and tools that you've started to develop in treatment and live your life independently. And coming back to, you know, most of our clients are in California. It's insane to live here. Mm-hmm. The costs.
Yes, exactly.
Which invites dependency, right? Because that you kind of are required to have ongoing parental subsidies, because living on one's own without not just a good job but a very good job is unrealistic in the types of parts of California that our clients are coming from.
And I think that's a great point. What are some of the other boundaries that can be set? Because obviously they're saying they're not coming back in. The assistance in regards to employment. You know, are there other things that can be done where parents can still feel as though they're meeting that little bit of that codependency need by helping, but not bringing them back in and giving them the video game again?
Well, part of what we have to do is determine, is the child using that subsidy effectively at that point? So let's say someone goes through treatment and they need some ongoing support for college or living circumstances. Well, if that young person is leading a healthy, productive lifestyle, there's no reason why parents shouldn't continue to support and subsidize that if it's done with, you know, healthy limits and boundaries, and if the child is taking good advantage of it. That's what we all want to do,
sure.
Right? It's just that in the context of kids that are self-destructing, it's counterproductive. But if you're giving a $500 a month subsidy and the kid's smoking pot all day, right, you're basically paying for his pot. Let's not do that, right? Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say pot anymore. It's THC because it can be gummy bears.
Exactly. And actually, there was something in the news recently, and I don't know if you saw it, but where the, and I want to say he was in his 30s or whatever, was suing sued his parents for asking him to leave.
I love that.
I know.
That was great.
Yeah. I did like the fact that the judge found in favor of the parents that said that they actually do have the right to ask their son to leave in his 30s and to go make a life for himself.
That's the definition of chutzpah. I mean, how did that even get to court?
Yeah, exactly.
But some of these things, you know, we actually deal with. They're funny because they're so absurd that it became a national viral story.
Right.
But there's also an epidemic of people that are continuing that.
To do the same thing.
To do the exact same thing. It just doesn't make national headlines.
Or the courts.
Or the courts.
I know.
That was great.
So now, one of the things that I know that you have, and it's referred to as the Bowden Pyramid of Development. Share a little bit about the Bowden Pyramid of Development and how you use that with families.
Well, it's a ripoff of Maslow, so let's just acknowledge that okay. Out of the gate. And if you picture a pyramid, at the bottom is safety, and then ultimately self-esteem and self-confidence. Identity is the next level up. The level after that is healthy relationships. And above that is educational, vocational pursuits, and ultimately the future. So there's five sections going up vertically. I talk about that because a lot of people come to us concerned about the fourth level up, academics, mm-hmm. educational pursuits.
Sure.
And that's where we're really seeing the signs that we haven't developed. But ultimately, if we look at the bottom phases, most of the clients that we deal with are stuck at self-esteem and identity. That they're, if you take the mm-hmm. 30-year-old who's on the, or the 27-year-old that this woman wrote in about, that kid fundamentally has not had any success or achievements or any wins in a number of years. I can pretty much guarantee
right.
that. And ultimately, and whether he has an emotionally safe world or not, his father passed away, that's sad. His mom is, you know, codependent, and you know, who knows about physical and emotional safety. But most of our clients are stuck at self-esteem. They haven't had successes or accomplishments, and therefore they haven't engaged in healthy relationships. All right, that kid's got some kids he's gaming with online who he thinks are his friends. You know, and he's sincere about it, but they're not real healthy relationships, reciprocal interpersonal relationships in the real world. And so ultimately, a big part of why we send kids outdoors, not indoors, is that they have the opportunity for physical, concrete accomplishments all day, every day, start to build a sense of self-confidence and self-esteem, and actually achieving things that are very real and immediate. And that's ultimately the foundation, getting some small wins, to feeling self-confident enough to go forth and continue to build the rest of the levels, typically in a longer-term young adult transitional living program, where they can continue to have the wins, you know, in a scaffolded way for a while to develop new habits, new skills, and new tools. And what happens is, as the young person has some successes and wins, the parents in tandem start to have a greater level of trust and confidence in the child and a greater ability to step back from that codependent dynamic.
Right.
they still have to be the ones who stop first.
Yes.
That's really important. They have to break the rules of the game first. But that allows the kid to step into the ownership of his adult life.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. You know, and again, it's focusing on the parent and the parent having to look at themselves and realize, what are you getting out of this?
Yeah, and that's counterintuitive,
yeah.
Right? It's not how we're taught to parent. But there's a whole huge industries teaching parents about how to be and how to control the outcome for their child. And I'm saying exactly the opposite. You have no control. You never did. Here's the converse, Alan. You know, you've been to those parties where parents are talking about where their kids are going off to college and they're puffing out their chest and you can mm-hmm. just see the ones.
Oh, yeah.
My kid's going to Harvard or Penn or wherever. Somehow that implies they had something to do with it. Well, sometimes they did. They helicoptered their kid into straight A's. But more often than not, it's on the kid, right? We got to give them credit. It's really the converse of what I'm talking about. Like, parents didn't cause these problems. They had no control anywhere. They controlled their kid doing hard work to get into Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
But we see them, right? You know the ones I'm talking about.
Oh, absolutely. No, and I think we all have a bit of it, you know. I mean, I know that, when my youngest, when he went off to college and stuff, I was proud, But, I looked at it as I was proud for him because I know
right.
that he reached a point to where I said, if this is what you want, this is what you're going to have to do
right.
to reach that.
Right.
None of us are going to class for you in doing this work, but based on where you've put yourself now, you need to get straight A's from here to here to be able to get into the school that you want to go to. And so my pride comes from the fact that he did that work to get into the school.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right. And I work really hard at hiding that pride. My kid's not looking like that guy.
Yeah, I know. But I wear it. I admit it. I mean, I know that I have that.
But it's pride in them and their efforts.
Yes.
Not that you somehow have caused it or done it. Sure, you've been a good role model and you've had the right values, but that's existential. That's not mm-hmm. something that you're going to make them do.
Yeah, yeah, and you're right. And many of the people that we encounter don't see it the same way.
Yep.
So now, for the families that are out there, or for some of the parents that are out there that have their 27-year-old living in their basement, watching TV, playing video games, and have 17 pizza boxes under their bed, and they have no idea what. Is the type of thing that you can provide from an extraction planning that can help them to kind of go to that next step to start, extraction planning. How can they start planning this to make it work?
So, usually what I do with them, and there's no reason they can't do it on their own, is get in front of it, first of all, because I think too often the families have been reactive and not proactive. They've had to react to whatever new scheme or drama or challenge or arrest has confronted them. So the first thing is, let's get in front of it. Let's pick a date. Okay. Let's pick August 1 and let's present a clear message that by August 1, we will give you $3,000 for first and last month's rent. You will have identified someplace else to live. If you're smart, you'll get a job and start saving some money. And if not, that's on you. And then let the person go. But the words are essential here. A clear message, not, they tend to get really muddy,
mm-hmm.
right? All sorts of plans and contracts and this. No, it's a clear message. By X date, you're out. Here's the money we'll give you to start your life. Consistent.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to?
No. And I was just going to say, and when you say set a date, the vision that I'm getting, and I'm not sure the listeners are, but in setting a date, try to have them involved in that setting that date,
Sure. Yeah, you want to say, well, what kind of timeline do you need? Here's what we're thinking, but let's set it together.
Yes.
And here are the things that you probably want to do.
Right.
And here's what we're going to provide that's going to be fair. And then provide that message consistently and build the credibility. Because parents, we lose so much credibility because we've made threats or promises.
And didn't follow up.
And didn't follow through. So by the time they're getting to me, we've got no credibility. So we've got to find some little ways to become credible. Usually by naming it first. We know we've been
right.
not credible because we have not followed through. And then cohesive, because the parents, if there are two parents, are usually split in some way, right?
Exactly.
Either deliberately on the part of the kid in their manipulation, or, you know, they're sort of some money on the side and under the table. So those, the four C's, you know, there's no reason why families can't do this on their own, but find that date, find that what feels like a fair launching. And I think parents also get confused on, we're kicking them out.
Yeah.
And so, that is never the message,
right?
The message isn't we're kicking out. The message is we're going to give you a fair launching pad.
Because we love you.
Because we love you. And it's up to you as an adult to take advantage of this fair plan. And if you don't, you've owned your adulthood. We can no longer own it for you. Mm-hmm. And you will make your choices. And we will accept the possibility that you'll make some bad choices. And we will accept the outcome. We're going to let go of the erroneous belief that we have any control over what you do. We're going to give you a fair launching so we can sleep at night. Mm-hmm. And what you choose to do as an adult is on you. You're welcome to come home for Sunday dinners and whatever. We're not getting you out of our life. We'll always love you and welcome you here if you're healthy and constructive and positive in your life. And this way, it's a hard, everything I'm saying makes sense, I think, right?
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
I think it's the hardest thing to do.
Oh, yeah.
It's really the hardest thing I watch parents do.
Yeah, of course, yeah. And yeah, I think we run into a lot of the same things. Yeah, for everybody out there, we are talking with Douglas Bowden. Our subject is breaking the cycle of codependency between parents and their young adults. We're going to take a break. We will be right back. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service, licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services and West Shield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Our guest is Douglas Bowden, and we have another question that has come in, that has been emailed in, and this one reads, I agree that we are in an epidemic of codependency. I can't believe the number of my friends who have 30 and 40-year-olds still living at home. I would understand 20-somethings who may still be in school, but these are adults who should be out making a life and having their own families. Every one of them that I have had a conversation with is pleasant, but appear to be in a quasi-anxious state or with a blank look on their face. I said to my wife that it is a generation of zombies. What is your thought? And this is from Jim in Los Angeles.
Well, sure, it's a generation of zombies. How can you disagree with that? We're all, you know, on our phones and walking around, and yeah. But I think he's asking a really good question, because we do have a generation of people that, look, I think the notion of adolescence has gone into the 20s, that the kids are staying at an adolescent phase of development much later. Similarly, what we've also seen is the notion of childhood going into adolescence. So everything is being pushed older.
Mm-hmm.
That's the piece that doesn't get discussed. Have you noticed how many kids are not getting driver's licenses these days? It's unbelievable.
Yeah, I saw that as well. Yeah.
It's related. I think that it comes back to the generation of parents that are parenting these 20 and 30-year-olds, and our belief that we have to do everything for the kids. We're also an indulgent culture where we have the means to overindulge our kids. I don't think a generation ago as many people had the means to do it.
Good point.
So it's partly a socioeconomic shift. I think in probably families where there's not the means to do it, we don't see the same epidemic, would be my guess. But there's also, we've sort of accepted this notion that we don't necessarily have to achieve, right? And this is, again, our society that, hey, you know, things are tough, things are bad. I only can get a job as a barista if that, and I don't really want to. So there's, I think we've also internalized this anxiety that we can't achieve in certain circles unless we're achieving at the very top. You know, if you're in Silicon Valley or here, if you're not, it's that stratification.
And what's your thought on from the standpoint of when we're being asked to actually work or, you know, to provide any sort of income at all? Because I know my thought is going back, you know, the idea of working was, I mean, as soon as you can get a paper route, as soon as you can get a busboy job, you know, all of these things. And, you know, you had to get a permit from your high school, but most of us had it. You know, you got the permit from high school so that you could work at some job and start learning how that works. I think now, I mean, those jobs are gone. And so we really have kids starting to go out and look for their first job out of college.
Right. There's no paperboys anymore.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's not a thing. Well, there's no papers.
Yeah, that too.
Right. You know, I think it goes back to the indulgence at some level, right? We have the means to do this. And another economic expression is that I like, out of deprivation comes motivation. Well, a 25-year-old who's sitting gaming all day, 8-10 hours a day, and has the 17 pizza boxes, they're not deprived of anything. They've got the stimulation. They've got the socialization, right? They think they're doing something, and it becomes habitual. So they're not deprived of anything. And this is why, to me, I go back to, we've got to stop the subsidy. You always get more of what you're subsidizing, economics. And the families don't get that because they are somehow meeting their own needs by meeting the needs of their child. They somehow feel like they're better parents by supporting them when the child's being the victim or he's depressed or he's addicted to pot or whatever. So they're getting their own needs met to feel like they're good parents. That's the Cohen in codependency.
Yeah. I mean, as you were saying that, I was thinking it's a story which I think I've told on the air before, but with my oldest son when he was in middle school, he came home and told me that a much larger boy was extorting him for money. And so the way he explained it was the boy came up and said, "Give me $5 for lunch." He said, "Why am I giving you $5 for lunch?" He says, "Because I'm hungry." So my son reached in his pocket and he said, "I've only got $2 extra, but if you're hungry, I'll give you that." So he gives him that. And the kid says, "Tomorrow, you bring me the other $3 you owe me, or I'm kicking your ass."
Wow.
So my son tells me this story. The codependent dad in me almost immediately wants to get on the phone to the principal.
Sure.
I'm going to get on the phone. I'm going to fix this right now because this is not going to happen to my son.
Absolutely.
And my son looked at me and said, "Dad, can you not fix this?"
Right.
"I got it." I'm like, "Okay. Well, I couldn't control." I mean,
it's every fiber of your body.
I know.
Right? Go and throttle this kid.
I know. You know. So I came up with an idea on how I could satisfy me and satisfy what my son is saying. And I typed up a letter of exactly what my son had just told me. And I typed it up and dated it and signed it. And I put a copy in his backpack and I kept a copy for me. And I said, "Whatever happens, if you have to do anything, give this to the teacher." And what ended up happening was the kid did take him out. They went out in the back field, and my son had a martial arts background, and when the kid took a swing at him, my son put the kid down.
How good did that feel for you?
Oh, Alan? Yeah. When the principal told me that, I had this big smile and then realized I shouldn't be smiling about this,
right.
But I couldn't help it.
Right.
But the beauty of it was that when I got the call from the principal to come down because my son's been in a fight, I went down there and she showed me the letter and said that because of that letter, the other kid is getting suspended and my son isn't. But she said the part that she, the other reason why he wasn't being suspended was he knew to put the kid down, but once he was down, he didn't do anything. He didn't try to hurt him. He just, he was defensive in everything that he did. I felt like that was one of those things to where it was like, okay, I satisfied my issues, but I was able to let my child do what he felt was right. And I loved the fact that he was even strong enough at that point to see where I was going and stop me.
Right.
You know,
that's a strong, that's a great story, because that, yeah, that it's so emblematic of what it feels like, right? That,
yeah,
that sort of gut instinct,
yeah,
that you're going to protect. And that's a very normal, natural thing. But it also shows a certain self-awareness or mindfulness on your part that, wait a minute, I've got to let him develop and grow in his own way. And I think that a lot of times the kids that I end up dealing with weren't given such opportunities because their parents, out of their own fear and anxiety of what would happen, step in, control, and don't allow the child to develop the kinds of skill set and self-advocacy that your son clearly has.
Yeah, and but as I said, that it probably wouldn't have gone that way if he didn't stop me, if he didn't tell me, Dad, let me do this.
Well, that's why it's a great story, because I think any parent can relate to that.
Yeah.
Or at least dads.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. That we want to solve it ourselves. We want to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what it does ultimately, by fixing it for them, it's deprivation. It deprives the child of the opportunity. And I think when you talk to a parent about deprivation for their child, it also resonates. It's just, again, a little counterintuitive that what I'm doing by meeting their needs for them is I'm depriving them of their right and their responsibility to grow up, take ownership of their own adulthood. So when you talk in terms of deprivation, I think parents get it.
Yeah, and as you were saying, it actually reminded me of another story, which for those our age, we know that there was a Freddie Prinze Sr., at least my age anyway. There was a Freddie Prinze Sr., there is now a Freddie Prinze Jr. that, you know, is an actor and such. Well, Freddie Prinze Sr., at a very young age, he was a successful comedian. He was a good-looking young man, and he was starring on a successful TV show called Chico and the Man. And he had everything. And nobody had ever said no to him. And he had a girlfriend that broke up with him. So he committed suicide. He shot himself because he had never been told no. And I read about it afterwards. And because success had come so easily to him, just nobody said no. I mean, he was funny. He was handsome. He had everything going. He had a ton of money. And one of the things in one of the interviews one of the parents had said was, you know, he didn't know how to deal with being told no.
But that's sort of our culture. That's sort of our parenting. We have books now,
right,
about how to help set limits and get your kids to be more resilient. We've got free-range parenting. I mean, that's a thing. Like, we have to call it something because it's so opposite from how we've been parenting. And so that story about Freddie Prinze is sort of emblematic of how a lot of kids are being raised.
Yeah.
They're not being told no. They're not having the opportunity. They're being deprived,
exactly,
of those opportunities to develop resiliency.
Well, and which is one of the reasons why, when you brought the term up, being deprived, and what made me think of the fact that we're also in a society now to where suicide is at an all-time high.
Right.
Okay, why is that? Okay, this may be one of the reasons, because they don't know how to deal with anything because they've never had to deal with anything.
Right, and there's also a lot of things coming at them. I would not want to be a teenager today and deal with social media and all the anxiety that creates.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Look, you know how I feel about regulations and government, but if there's one area where we need to figure out how to limit access, it's with adolescents and phones and devices and screens and social media, because we're learning more and more. This is off topic, right?
Yeah.
But it's more and more, I think it's related to the anxiety and the suicidality.
Absolutely.
But I think there's more and more damage happening that, the developing brain is being deprived.
Well, and being as you brought it up, it's actually happening in more ways than just the way in which we're talking about, because I've had guests on this show now that is talking about as far as the waves themselves, you know, the actual things, the way it's affecting our brain waves by having them on, you know, I don't use the headsets anymore, you know, the Bluetooth headsets anymore, because after sitting and reading about what it does, it really is causing more problems as well. So that's even more reason to the screen time, the Bluetooth, the whole thing.
Well, that's why I'm wearing this tinfoil hat.
Yeah. Yes. And for those watching on Facebook Live, I know that, I want to go back to a little bit more about what you're doing to help. And I know that you have a mentorship program, and I know you started it about 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. Share a little bit about that, so I think people will understand some of the things that are being done out there or that can be done.
I want to make sure I'm sharing credit with Austin, who started it. He really started it, and I was smart enough to get out of his way. So I call it accidental brilliance, and basically it's the notion, and it makes perfect sense. You know, I've got these guys in their mid-20s who are compelling role models working with kids, and we're letting the parents step out as these mentors are working with the kids themselves, you know, 14, 16, 20, to figure out their own direction, but not as the parent's agent, really as the person to assist the young person as sort of their partner in accomplishing what they want to do, whether it's learning to surf, woodworking, fishing, getting a job, getting out of bed in the morning, mm-hmm. learning to ride the bus, right? Some of these things that are just, you know, back when we were raised with the free range parenting, we had to kind of figure out, right? So that's been a tremendous addition, a lot of growth in that. It's been great.
Well, I mean, I think it's great as well, and I know that there's more of that going on to where parents are realizing that, you know, you can bring somebody in to help, but I love the fact that it's somebody that's coming in that the young person is not looking at it as, oh, well, this is just an extension of my parent.
We work really hard to make that clear up front and to keep that boundary with the parent, because it goes back to their desire to control. So we can tell on the front end, is this someone who's looking for someone else to control their kid because they can't, right? Versus, are we really stepping back enough to give the room and the space for that kid to take ownership of what he or she wants to do? And that's a big difference, and it's really hard, because I think parents have been inculcated to believe that they're supposed to be controlling all these things, that they're somehow responsible for the children's success. And it's just, led to believe we have a lot more control over these things than we really do.
Couldn't agree more. So, if you had the power, oh, I'm sorry. Let's say if I had the power to place you in charge of fixing the codependency problem, what would be the first three things that you would do? So we talked a little bit about, you know, there should be some things that can be legislated. And I know that, and we're not really, we don't believe that everything should be legislated. But what are three things that could be done or that you would do if you were given that role?
King for a day.
King for a day, exactly.
Well, I think we've built a dependent culture, right? And it's both in terms of the how the government operates and the numbers of people that are net recipients of government largesse, and the same thing is happening on the micro level in the households. I would name it. I think it's been named. I don't think it's done anything about it. I don't think we're going to end it. But I think, and this is why I wanted to come here, you know, to talk about codependency, I think in a way that's different than how it's typically looked at.
Right.
So we'd broadcast this show and make it mandatory. You know, I think another thing that we could do is stop indulging the codependents. I think there's a lot of professionals who take advantage of the parental anxiety and fear. You could say, you know, in my case, right? You know, these people they're fearing what might happen if we don't intervene at a tremendous level, right? And I try to be very careful about whether I'm participating in an act of codependence with the families. You want a third thing?
Well, actually, before we come back to the third thing, as you were saying that, it just reminded me of a young person, and it kind of ties into what you were saying, a young person that I was speaking with, and we were transporting him to a program in Utah. And as we're going there, he says, you know, this isn't my fault. And I said, well, nobody is saying that it is. You know, I said, you know, you're going to a place where, you know, there's people that can help and work with you and so on and so forth. He goes, no, he says, what I mean is, he says, my therapist told me that this isn't my fault, that it's because I'm being raised by a dysfunctional family.
Well, so that's probably the third thing, right? Yeah. We've also got a culture that has indulged this notion of victimhood.
Yes.
Right? That I'm a victim of, you know, bad parents. I mean, that's as cliche as it comes. But, you know, I think more widely, we've got, you know, snowflakes on college campuses that have been indulged and need safe spaces when their feelings get hurt. We've got that stuff going on. But that's emblematic of what's happening more broadly in the culture. That's not happening by accident. It's indulging a sense of victimhood. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the third thing.
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. You know, one of the things that I love to do in regards to the show, and we probably got about 4 minutes or so, is and I appreciate those that send in the comments afterwards, because we get comments that come back that say one of the things that they love are the success stories. Share with me a couple of your favorite success stories in working with families, so that people can sort of see maybe where things started and where they became at a later date when they got back in touch with you.
Well, I guess my favorite success story is the mentoring program, because these are young guys who went to wilderness programs and therapeutic boarding schools and came back ultimately. And name anything bad a kid can be doing in their teens, and I don't want to lay them out, but we can use our imaginations. And to come back and want to give back, to want to work with the kids themselves, I mean, to me, that's astounding. It shouldn't be astounding. You know, and I've got three guys now that have been through programs who are now working with other young people. And the thing is so they're giving back to this next generation of young people who are deriving more benefit than they would just by being with a clean person, but being with someone who's been where they've been,
right,
and can relate. And I've seen, so that, to me, it's almost success by proxy, right? It's like, these are guys that I helped, and very, very proud of it.
Well, and more than your story, this is now their story.
This is their story, exactly.
Yeah, so which is great.
Right, and you know, and that's related to countless kids that I've had that have helped get back into working in wilderness programs, and they're giving back. And I can name six wilderness therapists today who are former clients of the Bowden Group. Mm-hmm. Those are tremendous stories, because it's affecting lives with a sort of multiplier effect, right? So to me, it's broadly that kind of story. And I would say that the whole group, I you know, it's me, but it's the other people on the team,
sure,
that are there currently, historically. So that's been, you know, the really gratifying part of a 25-year career.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, we are just about out of time. I mean, for everybody out there, you know, if you get the chance, I mean, go to the website, you know, share this out with somebody that you know, because I think we all know somebody that is dealing with some of these issues. And Doug, I just really want to acknowledge you, you know, for you and your group, for the things that you're doing, because that's kind of what you're, I mean, you're paying it forward. And so you have people in now, generations of people that are now paying it forward to helping the next generation. So I just really want to acknowledge and thank you for what you're doing out there.
Thanks, Alan.
You're very welcome. And for everybody out there, please be sure to put on your calendar and tune in next Monday, when our special guest will discuss her new book, Work That Matters, Create a Livelihood That Reflects Your Core Intention. So see, that ties right into what we've been talking about. And please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. And if you like what you hear, please leave a review. It'll help us. It'll reach more people, and it's greatly appreciated. The next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page. Check out some of the latest posts. If you like what you read, please like us. Be good human beings, and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.